I'm Sonia Morton-Firth and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton-Firth Show. Today my guest is Philip Carpenter, DJ, cabin crew, TV reality star and British Army veteran.
I will never be fulfilled in my life. I will always want more and I will never stop striving for more. Right? And I think that it's sad, isn't it? It's a curse actually, because if I was truly content in my life, it'd be a peaceful blessing. Because I'm always searching for the next big thing or trying to do better or make more money or to achieve more. There's always that next target.
Philip spent his military career protecting diplomats, including the Prime Minister, David Cameron, in high-risk situations. After leaving the military, he travelled the world looking after some of the wealthiest billionaires. We talk about one man's endless search for success and happiness and who is the real Philip Carpenter.
So I think I'm still finding myself. And I don't know, if I'm honest, if I'll ever truly find out who I really am, because I think I'm searching for something, right? I think I have been for a long time. So the military was a big part of my life. It's not who I am, it doesn't define me, but it's part of who I am.
Philip, it's a pleasure having you on my show today. And I'm normally having people at my house, but we're not at my house today. We're in an amazing location, a veteran hotel in London. Philip, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure. And I'm here for a week in London, central London, and it's brilliant that we got this opportunity to have a chat. Super excited.
I'm really excited. And when I read a bit about you, Philip, I didn't actually know where to start. So you've been a DJ.
Yeah.
You've been a cabin crew, Trolley Dolly, and you've been on a TV reality show.
Yeah.
In amongst some entrepreneurial things you did as a 12-year-old.
Of course. Yeah.
How did you go from that to being in the military? First of all, why the military?
So first of all, I had to, when I was sort of at 17, half 18, and I'd come back from overseas, I thought I was going to join the Royal Navy and be an engineer, an artificer in the Navy. So I signed up, did all my exams, and day one of training, HMS Raleigh, I didn't turn up. Got a phone call, where are you? I'm not coming.
So why didn't you turn up?
To be honest with you, I don't think I was truly committed at that point.
Why did you decide to go into the Navy in the first place?
Because, to be fair, I felt that having some structure. I'd come from a upbringing where there were some challenges growing up, and I felt having that discipline and that structure. And I've always kind of worked in that way. Having another thing you could say, what have I taken away from my life, is that I do work best by having some sort of foundations and structure. I think that works for most people. If they're honest with themselves, if you're just fleeting from one thing to another, it doesn't really work.
I think you definitely have to have a vision.
And a vision. So my vision, to be honest with you, I just thought it sounded really sexy joining the army. I'm going to be honest. I thought that this was really Gucci,
so
sexy.
There was nothing sort of, I want to serve queen and country and do the good.
Initially, no. But once I actually became involved and went through phase one training, I really started to understand the reason, why people were joining the military. And I think that's when the Queen and country, and I've got to be honest, when I went and did my oath of allegiance at the Career Centre, that's when it really kicked in, what I was signing up to. Let's not forget at the time, we had wars ongoing in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I knew that I would be going to these places. And I think that was when it really kicked home. Listening to some of the stories of our instructing staff, what they've experienced, they've been through. It was really a reality check. I was a very young man, really doing it because I thought it would be really cool getting to play the guns.
How long were you in the military for?
So I served in the military. So I passed out of training and I did a number of career courses, became a physical training instructor in the military. Not that you can see that now, but I was. And I specialised in close protection. So I was part of the Royal Military Police close protection wing. I trained as a Royal Military Policeman, then specialised in close protection.
And you were close protection for David Cameron at the time, was that?
So through my career, the role of a close protection officer within the Royal Military Police is very much to provide close protection or security, personal security, to diplomats, foreign dignitaries, and politicians in austere or hostile environments. So and that's what I specialised in. And through my career, in the Royal Military Police, I have been lucky enough to serve, I say lucky, two ways of looking at that, but I have been honoured to serve looking after ambassadors in Afghanistan, and also I have been a bodyguard to Right Honourable David Cameron.
Any hairy incidents that you can share?
Yeah, of course. There's many incidents that I could go through. I think one of the notable ones from a CP perspective is I'd landed into Kabul, Afghanistan in 2012. It's quite a big one, really quite prolific, and it was very well publicised at the time. So I landed, we'd only been in country 5 or 6 days at the time. We were still actually handing over to another team. A major complex attack came in from a very close overlooking hotel called the Kabul Star. So there was RPGs going over, landing into adjacent compounds, small arms fire. The gate was stormed by insurgents. Quite a very difficult environment. At that time, our principal, so the VIP or principal, the person we're there to look after, the ambassador, wasn't even in country. We were actually looking after the deputy ambassador at the time. But that day, the ambassador was landing into Kabul International Airport. So we had to facilitate not only dealing with this ongoing complex attack that was coming in on our location, but we also had to send out a team, hail of bullets effectively, to go and rescue our principal from the airport. It was well publicised. It was across the BBC and it was quite well reported because of the high profile nature of the location and obviously the people that were affected. So there's a number of different notable events, but that's, probably quite
were
a challenging
Were you in the line
one.
Of fire at any of...
So me personally, during this actual complex attack, I've got a bit of a funny story. So I was out in the open due to do a pickup from the deputy ambassador. We were going out on a mission and we heard the crack and whip of the round. So if they, it's going without going too complex, when it crack and whips, it means it's quite close. Yeah. So it, you can hear the round passing over your head or landing around you. So I was fortunate enough, I escorted my principal into the HQ building, called it the Chancery, and without saying too much, and obviously had to lock down my client into a safe room. So one of the things you do is you secure your client in a safe place or you extract them from the danger. Close protection officers are really paid to remove the principal from the threat.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's not, you're not actually engaging, you're trying to get away.
Get them, yes.
Professional, you're professionally running away, actually, in theory. So I remember being locked in with the deputy ambassador, who, for obvious reasons, I can't say too much, but, it was a lot going on. So she was trying to command and control, the security of the embassy and the occupants. And it's pretty scary, and I'm not going to lie, of course, when these things are going on all around you, it's pretty intense. And then you've got helicopters, above you. You've got rounds being returned. You've got it's very, very intense operating environment. It does change your outlook on life for me personally.
How did it change your outlook on life?
I think it just makes you very aware. I always thought I was kind of slightly invincible.
You'd been through being a hostage at 17 with you, yes. Being held over a balcony. Fag butts stuck on you.
Yes.
And then you've ended up in this situation where you're looking after or bodyguarding these diplomats. That must have some sort of an effect on you or your perceptions of life.
Well, I think, for me personally, I think, one of the things I will say is we're very well trained, very well kitted out, very well trained and very well supported. So I think what happens, and I think you've spoken to a lot of veterans, really what happens is the training kicks in and you the selfless commitment part, you kind of forget that it's not about you, it's about your friends, your colleagues, and your principal. Yeah, so you're there to do a job, to protect the client. That's what you need, to protect that principal, that VIP. So you immediately you kick into that and you're there to also work with your team and protect your team. And everything else really... It's weird to say, it's kind of a very strange feeling, but everything else goes out of the window. Everything else, all the problems at home, the bills need to be paid, the car needs to be MOT'd. You don't think of any of this. You can't think of any of this. You've just got to concentrate on the mission and what you're there to do. So for me personally, I look at you know, the sort of hostage, I think it's a nice way to put it. I've never thought of it as a hostage situation, but the hostage situation as a young man, you know, that was an untrained young man. This was a very well-trained young man who was very well supported and had a great team around him. So for me, it was mission and mates. So I first of all left the army on a Wednesday, and I on a Saturday was on a flight, a one-way ticket to Basra in Iraq. So I went out onto what we call hostile security, or hostile close protection. So I went out to work for a company. I won't disclose companies, if that's okay, that's but fine. I went to work out for a company based in Basra as a close protection team leader. So here I've gone from an army with the Gucciest kit and equipment and supported with helicopters and fantastic people to being with two B6 armored vehicles in the middle of Basra with a local national close protection team. So it was me and a local national team. I think later on I had a fantastic Kiwi guy called Aaron that came on and became my 2IC. So, and then I'm equipped with some, you know, whatever body armor and an AK-47, you know, sort of a Russian, old Russian weapon that was actually made in 1983, the year of my birth. I remember laughing about it. So I was laughing that my weapon was as old as me.
As old as you.
Yeah. So, you know, and that was a very different life, and that had its challenges. So although it wasn't deemed a war zone at that point, you know, most of these places, particularly post-conflict zones, end up in a sort of constant flux. There's a lot of tribal and militia type conflicts going on a regular basis. So it's always in a flux. There's always a security concern. And that's why we're there. So I was looking after oil and gas workers and management and moving them around their location, helping them facilitate through their jobs in that environment. It's quite a cut thrust industry. It's quite cutthroat. A lot of it's about money. Margins and the sort of private military world is a challenging one. I mean, I can give you, you know, the kind of environment is again without talking about people, names, and places. But here's an example of how the industry. It's quite murky. It can be quite murky, and it also can, you know, depends on who you work for and the contracts and everything. But here's an example. All weapons that you have to be on this sort of register, right, to legally carry that weapon. In that country, in Iraq. I remember carrying weapons that were not registered on this license. So effectively, we were carrying these weapons illegally. And we had to go through a checkpoint. And it's quite scary, you know. So I've got a local national team. I've got an expat 2IC. My primary concern is their welfare. Yeah, I've got no client with me at this point. We've already dropped the client off. But I've got to look after my team, make sure they get home safely at the end of the mission. So I remember... having to break these weapons down, you know, put bits under a mat, bit under the sort of car, you know, back of the seat, bit down the back of the seat, trying to hide these weapons in the vehicle. And these weapons got, you know, found, you know, they found these weapons. They found, I think we opened the door and they found a bit of a spring, sort of a recoil spring popping out underneath the mat. So we were all whipped out of the vehicle, you know, sort of plastic cuff, put down, you know. It wasn't a nice experience with Iraqi Secret Service. And interrogated, and you know, this kind of murky world is, we sent our local nationals off to jail, somebody comes down, hands over a bag of money, and problem solved. And unfortunately, you know, that is the world, that is how that country, to some extent, operates. But a wonderful country, I made some fantastic friends, and a wonderful people. But it is, you know, there are some really big issues there, and I just don't think it's ever going to change. And you know, it's very sad. I mean, I spent 2.5 years doing that.
So what strikes me of all, you've done so many different things.
Certificate collecting.
I mean, let's get down to it. Who is the real Philip? Have you found yourself yet?
So I think I'm still finding myself. And I don't know, if I'm honest, if I'll ever truly find out who I really am. Because I think I'm searching for something, right? I think I have been for a long time. So the military was a big part of my life. It's not who I am. It doesn't define me. But it's part of who I am. So I worked in that environment. Then I went on to work in executive, what we call executive close protection. So look at, again, I can't disclose, but you know, but look at the names and positions. But I looked after senior, wealthy, ultra high net worths in Kuwait, and also a Saudi royal family member. Again, I won't go into too much detail. Traveled all over the world in that role, and I'm talking, you know, off
So what jets, brought you back? Because you're
gold
not
gold cutlery, gold toilets, you know, you name it, it's brilliant.
But not
gonna
you're
lie.
Not in that. You're in financial services because now. What brought you back to?
It took me away all the time. Effectively, I spent years working abroad, working 12 weeks away, maybe 4 weeks back, 8 weeks away, 4 weeks back. So in sort of the hostile close protection world, you know, it's quite regimented. There is a rotation. And when I was working with the more executive close protection, and as I'm teaching my students, you know, at the moment I'm teaching a close protection course in London for the UK's, one of the UK's leading training providers, you're always away. And I've got a 13-year-old who's now 13 at home, who was born in 2008. And, you know, if I'm honest, I've probably spent half of her life away.
How did that affect the relationship with your daughter?
So I'm very fortunate. My daughter's very resilient because she's grown up, you know, used to that. Right from, you know, within the first 18 months of her life, I was abroad. So bear in mind, there was also 6-9 months of sort of preparation and pre-deployment training. So she's very resilient. So she's grown up with her father away. Then in 2015, I think years of being away on this private security circuit destroyed a relationship with my partner at the time. It wasn't perfect, but it didn't help. And so we broke up. So my daughter was kind of 6 then anyway. So she's kind of, now I'm this sort of weekend part-time father. It's really, in some ways it's quite nice because I get to do all the fun stuff. Pick her up and then drop her back, and mum does all the discipline.
Do you think you were running away?
Running away,
and I don't mean that in a literal sense.
No,
but
sure.
Was there something that you wanted to get away from? And
I think it was. To be honest with you, I don't think I've ever found sort of normality. Doesn't, I don't know if it's something I was born with or if it's my experiences have shaped me. Probably a bit of both. I am not very good at being in one place for too long. I don't know, you know, and I can't put my finger on it, unfortunately, of exactly why that is.
Do you feel fulfilled?
I will never be fulfilled in my life. I will always want more, and I will never stop striving for more. Right? And I think that's, it's sad, isn't it? It's a curse, actually, because if I was truly content in my life, it'd be a peaceful blessing. But because I'm always searching for the next big thing or trying to do better or make more money or to achieve more, or to, you know, there's always that next target.
I sort of see it differently. I think the fact that you're pushing yourself outside your comfort zone and choosing to search, a lot of people are quite complacent just to stay in their normaldom and not look outside. But
sure,
you have reinvented yourself. Not just once, not twice.
A couple of times.
Several times you've reinvented yourself. What learnings have you taken from that?
Well, I think for me personally, it's never, you know, don't be afraid to try something. There's no hard and fast rule that says you have to be married at 35, you have to be married by 30, you have to have children before you're 35, you have to own a house before you're 30, you have to work a 9-to-5 job because that's what everyone else is doing. I think it's just having the courage to say, you know what, I want to give this a go. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out.
And was there any time that you were fearful, or what thoughts went through your mind, or did things come through your mind of when you thought, right, I'm going to do that job?
I think once you've been in the military, it's very difficult to adjust to, we've got some fantastic traits and we've got some fantastic attributes, and veterans can bring so much to any organisation. So anyone that's listening to this, you know, if you're thinking about hiring a veteran,
yeah, absolutely.
Don't be ashamed. You know,
no,
we really
have
some fantastic attributes that we can bring to any employer. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to speak to you, is to get that message out.
What sort of attributes can you bring to an employer, or did you bring to an employer?
Well, we work on a very simple basis. You know, the discipline, self-discipline is huge. The ability to just be somewhere on time, in the right dress, doing the right thing. The moral courage, and again, I feel like I'm going through these sort of army mantras, but, you know, having the ability to speak out where things aren't right, the moral courage to say that isn't right. But, you know, having the commitment, you know, the commitment to the job, to the person. You know, military people work so hard, and they give everything their all. you know, that's really one of the biggest attributes. You know, we're not shackled by this sort of, oh, it's 5 o'clock, we must go home now. You know, if we need to stay later, we will. So, I mean, I always give everything. And one of the reasons why I'm having some, you know, quite relatively good success in what I'm doing now with the organization I'm working for, in terms of, you know, the financial advising role, is because I apply those traits that I learned in the military to my life now. They're just things that are ingrained in me that will never go away, that perhaps I didn't have as a young man, a very young man, you know, being hung by the ankles over the balcony. You know, I think I've manned up a little bit, you know, excuse the expression. But
so what does a successful life look like for you now, Philip?
Well, for me personally, you know, building on what I'm doing at the moment, in terms of financial planning and wealth management, I generally enjoy it, because one of the great things about that job is speaking to people. So most of the days I'm speaking to people, and I'm still helping people, although it's in a different way than my time helping people in terms of the private security industry and the military. I'm still helping people just with their finances. And trust me, there's a lot of people that need help with their finances. Quite often the most successful people need the most help with their finances because they've got the most problems or things that need to be sorted. So I enjoy doing that.
I feel like if I met you in a year's time and we had this interview again, you'd be like an astronaut, something completely different.
Well,
is there anything stopping Phil Carpenter? Because I do believe you've done so many different extreme things. Have you got that vision of what's next?
There is something that I toy with, I fleet with. I think we're lacking a lot of, and this is my personal opinion, and I'm not, you know, not going to go into the whole political sphere of party politics or who you vote for, who you wouldn't vote for. But I do think that politics is lacking integrity. Honesty, integrity, and a real sense of doing the you know, looking after the people, doing the right thing for the people that who elect you. The people put you there, and you're there to serve the people, a public servant. And I feel that there is something in me that keeps making me think, would I like to go into politics?
You know, you've got the acting side down to a T. You've got that.
I've been tortured. I've got some stories, a couple of war stories I could throw out. I've got, you know, could I do it? I don't know. Could I relate to people? You know, speak to people, financial background, services background as well. You know, is that something that I fleet with these ideas just because I'm very frustrated? One of my biggest frustrations at the moment is the lack of honesty and integrity in politics. And that's whether, you know, whether you come back, we'll maybe sit down in 2 years' time and who knows, might be the election.
Prime Minister of England. Who knows?
Why not?
We never thought we'd get where we are, and there's been a few names certainly in the world that we didn't think we were going to get into those positions.
I've worked with some politicians. I've looked after some politicians, you know, interesting characters, some of them. And I think there is time to open up politics to people, the people. And that's, you know, maybe something. It's there. I don't want to say too much because the fear is my boss will watch the show and he'd be like, oh my God, you're leaving us already?
Yeah.
What, have you handed in your notice? Are you off? So no, that's not it. But it is something that I fleeting with the idea that perhaps it may
Philip, this has been such an interesting conversation. I feel like I could talk to you all day. I feel like there's so much more. But I have reached my final question.
Sure.
And that is, if you were to write a message in a bottle for future generations to find, what would the message be?
Well, that's good. I wish you'd give me some pre-notice of this question so I could have something really deep and meaningful and powerful to come out with. But I would, do you know what? I'm going to keep this really simple. I think it's a one-way ride. Life is a short journey. Make the most of it. Try it, buy it, live it. And if it doesn't work out, just move on to the next thing.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday. So hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.